Hello and welcome to the Politically Spooking Podcast.
Spooking!
The Halloween-themed episode.
Ooh, spooky.
We're covering politics so well that it's creepy. Well, I'm Chris McDaniel, a political reporter with St. Louis Public Radio, and I'm joined by...
I am Jason Rosenbaum, the Count of the St. Louis Beacon. How are you going to top that introduction?
I'm not.
Well, I think
Joe
that just
Manis
about does it.
With the St. Louis Beacon.
And I think that just about does it for the Politically Speaking Podcast.
Yeah, we were going off the air after that.
Okay. Let's talk about something really scary.
Yes.
The latest.
Yes. Well, a lot of things have happened in the McCaskill and Aiken race since last week. Since that happened, there was a debate, in fact, last Thursday.
Where both of the candidates looked like weird shades of color, as we were talking about before.
Yeah. Well, because it was the lighting in the studio. Basically, there wasn't that much, I don't think there was that much new information. It was basically Aiken and McCaskill both doubling down and heightening their differences. Yeah. I think the big news was that McCaskill was pretty candid in her meeting with reporters afterwards, and she did get one of the reporters there was airing some unsubstantiated allegations against one of her against her husband there, and McCaskill denied it, and then Aiken didn't show up in the spin room. And allegedly because of the Cardinals game, but he admitted the next day on a radio show.
That's become par for the course with him. It's like he has an event and just doesn't do a media meet and greet afterward, which I think...
He said he didn't want to step on his message in this case.
Yeah. I mean, that obviously irks reporters because we are curious people, but I mean, that's just something I've noticed over the last couple of months.
Well, it's not... I think it irks reporters. It's not so much an ego thing. It's just that if we're told somebody's going to be there and you're working on your story and then you want to get fresh quotes and get their perspective on what happened or didn't happen and then they don't show, in this case, with the debate, it meant that McCaskill actually was able to control more of the narrative of what happened in the debate, I think. I don't know what Chris thinks, but because Aiken wasn't there to – offer any insight beyond what he had said during the debate?
Well, one of the things was, you know, in terms of, you know, us, it's not being about an ego thing, but, you know, we didn't swarm the stage or, you know, all the reporters didn't swarm the stage because, you know, the understanding was we would go into the media room and the candidates would meet with us. In terms of, you know, setting the narrative, I did get to speak to Congressman Aiken for a few minutes afterward.
Because Chris was one of the questioners, so Chris was on the stage.
Yeah, you were one of the, and not just, and I'm not just saying this because, you know, you're a pseudo coworker, but your question was one of the better ones. I thought some of them were a little off kilter, to be frank.
Stem cells, yeah. It was a flashback to 2006.
And I mean...
Well, the stem cell, I think, was okay. I think the thing about the schools...
That was a really weird question, and neither of them answered it, but I really don't know if their decision-making on where they send their kids to school is really an appropriate question in a U.S. Senate race. And the question that Art Holliday did about what the media's reaction to if Nakin
that
wins, I don't think...
Flop.
Yeah. I'm not really sure that was an appropriate question either.
It doesn't really... I mean, you have to think in terms of what the viewer needs to know.
Right.
Not that we're experts, but at least I try to keep that in mind. So at least I'm making an effort to think, okay, what is the average person who's watching this or reading this or listening to this wants to know? And not so much, you know, what is, you know, my ego or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that said, that wasn't the only news with Aiken and McCaskill this week. The next 2 days later, he did step on his own message.
Yes,
when he's in Springfield at a rally. And he refers to McCaskill as a fetching dog.
Yes,
he's referring to what he said was that basically she was doing the errands of whatever President Obama needed.
She was going to D.C. picking up taxes and regulations, bringing them back, and then dropping them.
He just really needs to stop making analogies to things. This one was not only, you know, had the offensive connotation to it. I think the Riverfront Times wrote an article that just didn't even make any sense, to be honest. So,
well, here's the thing.
I don't know.
On Monday, Congressman Aiken appeared on St. Louis on the Air, and our host Don Marsh asked him about this statement. And during the interview, Congressman Aiken was saying that, you know, we have to focus on the issues. We can't just focus on these statements that I've made. And, you know, we can't just talk about, you know, these scandalous comments that I make. But then not 10 minutes after the congressman and his staff left, that is when Rick Tyler tweeted out a joke about the dog issue, saying that if Claire McCaskill was a dog, she would be a bull shih tzu.
Yes. Now Rick Tyler, so listeners know,
yes,
is a top consultant with Aiken at the moment, and he's national and had previously been with Newt Gingrich.
Known right. for his zaniness.
Yes, very zany.
Yeah, we need to work that in.
So there are some mixed messages here in terms of let's focus on the issues and in terms of, no, I'm going to keep going back to the dog comment.
Well, so, and then that day, also, this had been out there for a while about Aiken is strongly opposed to abortion, and he has acknowledged for over a year that he had gotten arrested in the 1980s during the height of the protests in St. Louis. I am old enough that I actually covered a number of those protests. He didn't stand out to me at the time. He wasn't an elected official. It was just part of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But he acknowledged that. Well, then Monday and Tuesday, it came out, the Post-Dispatch had gone through their archives in more detail than I had a few weeks ago, and someone had checked and discovered that actually the reason he wasn't found was because his first name was different. It was listed as William Aiken instead of Todd Aiken. Todd is his middle name.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually he'd been arrested at least three times, and a couple cases had been carried away from being too close to the abortion clinic's doors. He does not dispute that. McCaskill's campaign, though, is saying that this is yet another example that shows that he's an extremist. His campaign is saying that this is old news, and it just fits in with the narrative that he's anti-abortion.
Right.
So
wouldn't it have been more damaging if it was found out that, you know, he had been anti-abortion all these years and then had, you know, protested in favor of abortion rights? It just seems to be more in line with what we all think.
Well, the audience, her audience is clearly aimed at the sliver of moderate, particularly women voters in the middle, who A, may not have been aware of that, B, who may not like McCaskill, but she's trying to point out to them, do you really want to vote for this guy? And that message may or may not work. It may send them to Jonathan Dine, who's the Libertarian. Of course, McCaskill doesn't care about that as long as they're not voting for Aiken. At the same time, as I said, Aiken's camp is continuing to roll out more accusations about her husband's companies, and so it's gotten kind of down in the not dirt, but down in the nitty-gritty personal stuff. And I ran into Rick Tyler yesterday at an Aiken event that I was covering for something, and he did tell me on the record, he said that they have been doing polling, as are the McCaskill people, and he contends that they've been testing these attacks against Aiken and the attacks against her as far as the family businesses. And he contends that the family business attacks help Aiken by about 5 points. Now, I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying this is what they're contending,
right,
but it is an interesting contention that they think that is more of a winning message. But so far, they have not had much money to get these accusations on TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so most of what TV viewers are seeing are these attacks against Aiken, not against him.
Well, when I woke up this morning, I was surprised to find an email from the Spence campaign with the headline, Dave Spence and Jay Nixon to debate Friday, October 26th. And I was very surprised and taken aback.
Now, this is the contest for governor.
Yes, this is the contest for governor between businessman, not banker, Dave Spence and incumbent Democrat Jay Nixon.
Very tall incumbent.
Yeah.
Very tall incumbent. And up until this point, Nixon really did not want another debate. There was a forum about a month ago in Columbia.
Yeah.
So I was very surprised to read that they were going to debate tomorrow. Since
that
was very short
notice. There's a shocking twist to this press release.
And,
a spooky twist.
And then I read the press release and found out that it will not be Nixon. In fact, it's the ghost of Jay Nixon. In fact, it is actually Bill Randles standing in for Jay Nixon. And Bill Randles is Dave Spence's senior policy advisor.
And he formally ran against Spence in the GOP primary.
Yeah, so yeah. Randles had been Spence's opponent in the GOP primary. That could be interesting.
I think it's funny.
I think it plays in with the whole thing. I wrote a short piece about just there hasn't been a whole lot of debates generally in the general election cycle. You know, some people might think for anybody. Not right. There's been one for governor, two for U.S. Senate, and none for
attorney general.
Yeah.
None for light gov.
Yeah.
Yeah.
None for secretary of state. None for state treasurer.
Yeah.
And in the old days, before you were born, there used to be at least there would be this marathon that the Missouri Press Association used to hold, and it used to take all day.
Yeah.
And you'd usually have I was at the Post-Dispatch then, and there would be at least two of us, and we would tag team different ones so we could write between while the other person was covering the next debate, and that didn't happen this year.
Some people may think that's a bad thing, and people get less information that way, but when I was talking with, you know, George Connor of Missouri State University, the go-to political science expert when it comes to state politics, he said it may not actually be that bad a thing, more of a sign of the time, since people are getting information about candidates different ways now.
Yes, from Beyond November and from The Beacon and from
St. Louis Public Radio.
I will say, though, that legislative debates, state legislative debates, are pretty common. And that is a great segue to our next section about the state legislature.
Well, one more point. Spence has injected $1 million this week into his campaign of his own money.
Yes, I had it first.
Yes, Joe, since you had it first.
Because
tell
I'm
us about
up
it.
All night.
Yes.
Which is another issue. Dave Spence had injected $500,000 on October 16th. And that was reported on October 18th. And everybody had that. And last night, before I went to bed at some ungodly hour, I was checking the Missouri Ethics Commission site like I always do every night and saw that he had injected another $50,000. That actually, he injected it on the 22nd, but it wasn't reported until late Wednesday, the 24th, which is within the 48-hour window. Mm-hmm. So that's $1 million within a week. And that will likely – it does help him cut the financial edge that Nixon has. As of the last campaign reports, Nixon had about $5 million left over to spend, and Spence had $1.5 million. Of course, we all know that Spence self-funds, so the expectation was he might put in some more money, and he did. And this also indicates why when I saw the governor on Tuesday, I'd asked him if there was any thoughts about – doling out any of his extra money to some of these other down ballot races in order to help other Democrats. And he kind of chuckled and made some comment that these are the kind of questions that I keep my thoughts to myself. I'm paraphrasing, but he was chuckling. But in other words, I'm not going to answer that. But after the $1 million last night, I thought, well, chances are the governor would be even less inclined because that Spence could write another check tomorrow or another check in a few days. And self-preservation is always the strongest for any candidate, no matter how generous they may be. And as said, he's the titular head of the Democratic Party, so he is somewhat responsible for what happens down ballot. But I think he feels that his first priority is to get himself reelected.
On the one hand, you know, someone like Susan Monty could probably use like a $500,000 ejection from Nixon, and that could probably be helpful for her. But on the other hand, he took the effort through his campaign team to raise all that money, and a lot of that money is from the Democratic Gubernatorial Association. So in many respects, I mean, while I'm certainly – that would certainly be a benevolent gesture, I mean, it can't be an expectation for somebody who hasn't raised as much money. So.
Oh, yeah, especially, as I said, when you've got Spence. Now, I was among a handful of reporters who did interview the governor on Tuesday, and this was at one of his official events, and he admits that that's a lot of what he's doing. He does some campaigning, and but he's also doing a lot of official events, and he says that that's because he sees that as his job, and that's what people want to see him doing, not campaigning. Yeah.
Now, we have talked a lot about the governor's race and, you know, the McCaskill-Aiken race, but some of the races that we haven't discussed as much are the state legislators. But Jason did have a great story going up.
Two stories.
Very detailed.
Very detailed
Perfect
stories.
Detailed.
Yes. I'm going to try to sum them up as much as I can in the brevity that was probably lacking in the story. So we'll start with the state senate, which is a little bit easier. There are really only four state senate races that conceivably could change parties. They're all seats that are held by Republicans to go Democrats. There's a couple which are kind of on the peripheral that if there's a Democratic wave, maybe they would be close, like Ryan Silvey's seat in Clay County, possibly David Pierce's seat in central Missouri. But, I mean, even when I talked with Julie Justice, she wasn't talking about that. They were talking about the Kurt Schaefer-Mary Still race in Columbia, the Gary Romine-Joe Fallot race in southeast Missouri, surprisingly, the Doug Leibla-Terry Swinger race in a very Republican district near Poplar Bluff, but Terry Swinger is kind of outperforming what a usual Democrat would do there. And the main one, which is in St. Louis, which is Jim Lemke versus Scott Sifton, which I guess is in Joe's neck of the woods. She's just been inundated with mail. And...
Yeah, and I've been handing a lot of it off to Jason because yes. I have a conflict since Sifton and I go to the same church.
Right. So that race, I think, is – I mean – every race is interesting. How many times have I used the word interesting to describe a race on this podcast? But that one is actually intriguing because you have two candidates who I think are genuinely working very hard. They're going door to door. They have kind of this experience, but especially on Lemke's case, of just being tenacious campaigners. I mean, the reason why Lemke's in the Senate in the first place is he's universally seen as just a tenacious campaigner. And instead of like playing it safe over his 4 years in a seat that was 50-50 last time and is now more Democratic yes. during redistricting, he's appeared as kind of this controversial figure on tax credits, unemployment benefits, the Missouri nonpartisan court plan, even red light cameras, which is kind of a peripheral issue.
But he's not promoting any of that now. In fact, on his flyers don't even say that he's a Republican.
Right. And so Sifton is almost the opposite on every single one of those issues. He's pro-court plan. He is taking a much different tact on tax credits. He's socially more progressive slash liberal than Lemke on pretty much everything. He's pro-abortion rights. He's for putting sexual orientation into the Human Rights Acts, both on a county level and on a state level. And Lemke is kind of a reputation as a social conservative. So there is that contrast, but the district has become more Democratic. So I really think there's a genuine uncertainty in what's going to happen in that race. It could really go either way. It could be dependent a lot on turnout. And I think that's the one everyone is kind of uncertain about.
Well, and their attacks have been mainly over who has missed more votes or who has taken more money from special interests.
That's... Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's what usually happens in legislative races. They don't really go on, you know, what are you doing on a certain issue? It's more of those things like, if you're taking a lot of money from or taking a lot of money from an interest group, or if you're taking a lot of lobbyist gifts, or you missed a lot of votes. I mean, that's a common tact to attack an opponent on. So that's kind of the lay of the land in the Senate. And it's a little bit easier to do. For the House, it's a little bit more complicated because there are a lot more races. There actually aren't a whole lot of races that are competitive. A lot of them were decided in the primary one way or the other. But there are a handful of races in the region and even more across the state. And a lot of them feature former Democratic people who lost in 2010 who are trying to make legislative comebacks in districts that are radically different than before. And I think you could see some instances where some of those people come back. I think it's widely considered, for example, that Jeff Rorta in Jefferson County is a favorite to come back after losing in 2010. But then you have things that are more uncertain, like in South County between Vicki Lorenz England and Gloria Brown. They're actually facing off against each other for the third time.
That's in South County.
South County. England won in 2008. Brown won in 2010. And I think everybody has called this the rubber match because each person has won once. And I mean, in districts like that, it's really hard to say who's going to win. And, you know, districts like, you know, in the Boot Heel and in Jefferson County and in Mid-Missouri and St. Charles. So it's hard to determine what's going to happen. I mean, the outcome is Republicans are going to be controlling both chambers. It's just a question of what the margin is going to be. In the Senate, for example, it could be, you know, one seat less than before, and they're still going to pretty much have an overwhelming margin. Or it could be 22-12 or something like that, and they kind of are one short vote short of that veto-proof majority. And in the House, it could be anywhere from basically the same as it is now, like 106, 105, to where the Democrats could gain 5, 6, 7 seats, depending on which way it goes. The thing complicating it for the Democrats in the House is they have to defend some seats that are currently held by Democrats. It's not like the Senate where Republicans are completely defending their seats. So you could have a situation where they gain a seat here and there, but they could lose one in the more rural areas of the state. So, you know, that's kind of my if you can believe that, that probably was a 5-minute lecture on House and Senate races. But that's kind of a brief summary of where the lay of the land is
right
now.
Well, and his story is excellent, and you really need to read it. And even the State House Speaker, Tim Jones, who I ran across at a political event yesterday, said Jason's story was extremely fair and extremely thorough. So it has a seal of approval from the Republican
leader in
the
House. I'm not sure if I want that, but no Democrats have complained. I'm sure after this podcast I will get some complaints. But I mean, it showed them that they have opportunity to gain seats. And even though Scott Dickhouse, the HRCC person, called some of these people zombies, and that was maybe
he's referring to the Democrats who are trying to get,
and that might be
back.
Seen as a pejorative. It is kind of when you think about it, these people were kind of lost their races before, and they are coming back, and they do have a good chance of going back. So while that might not be the most savory analogy that's being put forward, I mean, that's going to be one of the ways they gain ground.
And frankly, it's not unusual if somebody's lost their seat during an off year on either party to try to get it back during the general election, because the voter turnout is so much heavier that they may feel that more of their party – this is particularly true of Democrats, because Democrats tend to turn out better in general elections than in off years, whereas Republicans are generally more reliable.
Yeah. Well, you can find links to Jason's story, and that's where you can definitely comment about how you're unhappy with the zombie language being put in there. You can find a link to that at beyondnovember.org, which is where all of our stories are compiled. I am at stlpublicradio.org, and Joe and Jason are at stlbeacon.org. You can find me at CS McDaniel on Twitter.
At Jay Rosenbaum.
And at Jay Manis.
Well, we will be back next week regardless. Until then, so long.
Sweet dreams.
So long.